Welcome everybody to Division One of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for 1:30. The first one is People v. Cropper. Are you the attorneys for that case? Okay. Okay, we'll hear argument first in that case. And the second case is People v. Hicks. Are counsel here for that case?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we'll hear argument second in the Hicks case then. Let me just review briefly our procedures. I think you're familiar with them. We have 15 minutes for each side. We have a color-coded and digital timing system. It's blue, it's green when you start, amber when there are 5 minutes left, and red when your time is up. Since it's a digital system, you can determine for yourself if you're representing the appellant when you want to stop and how much time you'd like to reserve for rebuttal. But if you'd like me to remind you when you have a particular amount of time left, please let me know. You should be aware that the judges have read the briefs, and at least one of us has had the opportunity to review the record. So you may wish to focus on the legal arguments rather than the facts, but of course how you present the argument is up to you. You should be aware that there's a toggle switch on the podium that you may use to raise or lower it to suit your convenience. You should be aware also that we're recording the oral arguments and they're placed on the internet. So if there's any confidential or private information, you may wish to be careful about how you mention that during the course of your oral argument. Also, I would ask everybody to check to make sure that if you have a cell phone, that it's turned off so it doesn't inadvertently interrupt us during oral argument. And finally, I'd like to say that we're pleased to be joined this afternoon by Senior Judge Leonard Plank. So with all of that having been said, we're ready to hear the oral argument in People v. Cropper.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Freire, number 20010. I'm the Deputy State Public Defender appearing on behalf of Mr. Cropper. I intend this afternoon to focus my argument on the first issue, which is the Crawford issue, and specifically the issue is whether defense counsel's failure to provide notice under 16-3309, which is our LAD statute, whether that constituted a valid waiver of Mr. Cropper's right of confrontation. Before I get started, however, there's obviously been a lot of changes going on in this area of the law. And just as I was leaving my office, I received rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hinojosa-Mendoza case. The U.S. Supreme Court denied cert in that case. That cert petition had been pending since February of 2008 on the waiver issue. But the U.S. Supreme Court did grant cert in a Virginia case, and I will just quickly read what I got because I don't know what the Virginia statute says, but the new case, it's called Briscoe et al. Versus Virginia, case number 0711191, involves the constitutionality of a procedure used in Virginia that requires an accused to assert a demand to question the technician who prepared the lab report. The state Supreme Court ruled that if an accused does not follow the demand procedure, he surrenders his right to confront and cross-examine the report's author. So I don't have, there isn't access to that cert petition right now, so I don't know what the question presented is, but that's what they have agreed to look at next term. So I think this whole waiver issue still hasn't been decided, despite the fact that the cert petition in the Hinojos case was denied today.
Ms. Freire, before you continue with your oral argument, I'd like to ask you and Ms. Pratt both, in light of the new circumstances that you've just described and the Supreme Court's decision last week in the Melendez-Diaz case, do you think it would that you would like to submit a supplemental brief discussing these cases?
Your Honor, may I have a moment to consult with counsel?
Sure.
Thank you.
Please turn off the timer so it doesn't count. Thank you.
Your Honor, I don't know that we exactly have a consensus on that. I think with respect to Melendez-Diaz, since it's really dicta in that case that relates to the waiver issue, I don't know that the holding is particularly important. I think the dicta is very important, but I can tell you from my perspective and representing Mr. Cropper and trying to protect his appellate rights as best I can, I think resetting this so that we can, you know, focus on some of these cases. Obviously, I haven't read the Briscoe case, and so I don't know. I'm not in a position today to answer any questions on the distinctions between it and our case. And I think there's probably some other state statutes out there. I know that a number of petitions that were pending were granted and remanded for further consideration in light of the Melendez-Diaz opinion, and there were 6 cases. So I guess I would like an opportunity to take a look at those cases and see whether waiver was an issue in those cases or whether it was just testimonialness of the statement. So I guess I don't know that we exactly have agreement on it, but I guess it would be my request to, in light of really today's rulings, to have more time to brief that. However, I can tell the court I am prepared to proceed if the court wants to proceed.
Well, we would like to proceed, but I'd like to hear from Ms. Pratt. What is your view? Well, I think we, as I said, that we would like to proceed with the arguments to the extent possible. Actually, the judges had talked beforehand about the possibility of simultaneous supplemental briefs, but based upon what you're both saying, maybe it would be more feasible to have you, Ms. Frayray, submit a brief. Could you submit one within a week of today's date?
Yes, I would request 2 weeks. I'm supposed to be out of town on a previously scheduled vacation all of next week. And I could try to get it done this week, but I can do my best to get it done. It wouldn't really be a week.
Okay. Well, then we'll give you 2 weeks to submit a supplemental brief. And how much time would you like after that? I guess we have to give you the same amount of time to be fair and equitable. So we'll give you an additional 2 weeks to submit a response brief, and we would ask that they be no more than 2,000 words. So, and just direct them to the attention of the three judges on this division. So, and then that way we'll be able to fully consider the impact of, if any, of these new developments. So, but we, notwithstanding that, we will go ahead with the oral argument based upon whatever information and arguments you would like to present now.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, thank you both.
Your Honor, with respect to the waiver issue, obviously the federal cases that are relevant are Crawford and the Melendez-Diaz case. I think the Colorado cases that are relevant are the Hinojosa-Mendoza case, along with the Coleman case, which was decided the same day. And I think to a more limited extent, the Mojica-Simmental case, which has not yet been officially overruled by our Supreme Court. The reason I think
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just to make sure the time is running. Our counter doesn't seem to be moving.
It's not. Mine's not moving either.
Okay, so I'll make sure we're okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. The reason that I think that a waiver under our statute is not valid is because our statute does not require the prosecutor to give notice. And Melendez-Diaz talks about these simple notice and demand statutes. And I think that if our statute required the prosecution to provide advance notice of its intent to offer these reports into evidence, then requiring the defense to file an objection or a demand for that within the 10 days before trial, which the statute says, I think is absolutely fine. The right of confrontation can be waived. I agree with Melendez-Diaz that it is the timing of when that objection is made is the only thing the statute does is alter the timing to before trial. But our statute isn't a true demand and notice and demand statute, and that's where it falls down. In Hinojosa-Mendoza, the Supreme Court, Justice Rice, started her analysis with the purpose of the Confrontation Clause being to provide, quote-unquote, the opportunity for cross-examination. And it's not the opportunity for cross-examination. It is the confrontation of the evidence. It is testing the accuracy and the truthfulness of the evidence against the accused. Sometimes and mostly it's through cross-examination, but the rules of evidence give the prosecutors the right of cross-examination. That's not synonymous with the confrontation right. There is extreme value in having that witness sit on the stand and being able for the jury to see that witness's demeanor as he or she speaks the words. And oftentimes it's the demeanor that provides as much, if not more, information than the actual words testified to.
Ms. Farrell, if you're getting a little bit ahead of me, and
okay.
If I can ask you to go back for a second. I understand you're making the argument here that this was not a simple notice and demand statute,
correct,
which Melendez-Diaz supports, and maybe you have the right to tell me that you'll just deal with this in the supplemental brief. But the court did say, and this is page 20 of the majority opinion, many states have already adopted the constitutional rule we announced today, and then there's footnote 11. And in footnote 11, they cite Hinojosa-Mendoza.
Right.
So I guess I'm not sure. I guess I read that as the Supreme Court saying Hinojosa adopts the same rule.
Well, I think the rule that they're referring to is that this is a testimonial statement. The first time I read through that, I'm focused on waiver. But then I read through it and I think, okay, well, the constitutional rule is that this is a testimonial statement. And that under Crawford, if it's testimonial, you got to have a prior opportunity to cross-examine the witness if the person isn't present. I don't think the constitutional rule was the waiver. I think when you look at page 21 and they talk about the simple notice and demand statutes, they refer to a Texas statute and an Ohio statute,
correct,
which require notice and then a demand. Now, they do state in the opinion that a notice and demand, and they cite Hinojosa-Mendoza, but I think it's because, in our opinion, we put ourselves, the Colorado statute, we say in Hinojosa-Mendoza, our statute is similar to other state statutes where the constitutionality of them has been upheld. And if you look at each of those statutes individually, every single one of them requires the prosecution to give notice, including this Virginia statute. They have a requirement that you put it in a particular format and that you give notice to the defense so many days before trial. And then the statute in Virginia says, well, then the defendant can subpoena that witness into the trial to testify and to confront the person. But Justice Rice doesn't say they're the same. She says they're similar, and they aren't the same. And the difference is that notice is not required in Colorado. And I think an interesting case that I didn't cite in my brief is the Colorado case, the Crothers case, decided by a division of this court. It was after Crawford was decided, but it relied on the Mojica Simenthal case, and it upheld counsel's failure to demand under the statute because the prosecutor gave notice at the pretrial conference, and the opinion talks about that. Mojica Simenthal says, you know, we recognize that this statute could be applied in an unconstitutional manner, but in this particular case, it wasn't under Mojica Simenthal because the prosecutor notified the defense at the pretrial conference. And the way our statute is written, it requires defense counsel to guess at what is going to be admitted under the statute. There isn't any notice requirement, and unless you have notice, you can't have a waiver. You can't waive something that you don't know about.
Ms. Freire, how does that at all apply here when the trial counsel for Mr. Crawford apparently misapprehended the scope of 16-3309?
Well, I think that was a mistake on her part, although I really don't know how big of a mistake it was. I think she did misunderstand. She thought it applied to the destruction of evidence cases, and I think if There is another Colorado Supreme Court case out there that doesn't deal with this subsection of 1633309, and that's People versus Wartina, 156 Pacific 3rd, 469. And at page 471 of that opinion, it says the General Assembly largely codified the applicable constitutional considerations concerning destructive testing in 1633309. So even our Supreme Court has characterized this particular statute as dealing with destructive testing. So I think that is a reasonable interpretation. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. But I think what the record in this case clearly shows is that had she believed that this evidence would have been missable simply by putting in the reports, she would have complied with the requirements of the statute. I think it was a mistake on her part. And I don't think a mistake is a knowing waiver. I don't think she knew that in all cases you have to comply with the statute, and that's how it's been interpreted, at least in the trial courts. But I think if you look at the further record she made during the motion for mistrial, she said, I relied on the good faith witness list provided by the prosecution. They never told me that they were going to be introducing all of this by report. At the pretrial conference, which was February 2nd, which was 18 days before the trial started, prosecutor moves for continuance and tells the judge, I've got problems with my DNA person. And we don't object. We say we'll waive speedy trial. You know, there's no indication at that time that the prosecutor's intending to proceed by reports. He's asking for a continuance so that he can get the person here. The judge denies the continuance and says, well, you better figure out another way to get the evidence in. That's about all the analysis he does, but the prosecutor doesn't then respond and say, well, if I can't get the person, then I'm going to have to proceed by report. I think that would have been putting defense counsel on notice, but she just didn't know until the morning of trial that this stuff was going to come in under the statute.
Counsel, do you believe that an attorney can waive the confrontational issue?
Yes, I do believe that.
No, you don't believe it requires the Curtis advisement where it's on the record that the defendant intelligently waives cross-examination?
No, I don't think that that's required. I think the confrontation right can be required. I don't know that necessarily making decisions about what questions are and are not asked is waiving the confrontation right because the witness is sitting there. But certainly, I think within this context, if our statute had a notice provision and counsel didn't provide notice, I think that would be a knowing waiver of the right of confrontation. But I don't think you can impute that knowing waiver to the defendant if defense counsel didn't know about it to begin with.
Well, Ms. Ferrier, how does that square then with Hinojos Mendoza? And I understand we have to get to the statute, whether the statute is constitutional. But Hinojos Mendoza, the lawyer didn't know about the statute at all.
Exactly.
And the court said that's a waiver, that right. This counsel is presumed to know. So how could the facts be better if counsel knew of the statute but misinterpreted it?
Well, I guess because I think the Hinojos Mendoza analysis is incorrect, and I think that's particularly so if you look at it in light of Melendez-Diaz. You know, it's interesting that in Hinojos Mendoza, they cite to the Christie case, and in Christie, the court talks about informed inaction versus uninformed inaction. And they start with this presumption that counsel knows the law. So if counsel doesn't act under this statute, we can presume from that presumption that this was an informed inaction. And I don't think you can make that leap logically. The Melendez-Diaz case talks about how the state advanced the argument under its statute that the opportunity for cross-examination was available, therefore there was no confrontation problem. And the Supreme Court said, you know, there's a difference between the compulsory process clause and the confrontation clause, and that doesn't ensure the right of confrontation. And it's the prosecutor's burden to bring the witnesses in and not the defendant's burden to bring in adverse witnesses. So, I think that is a faulty presumption. I mean, the lawyer in Melendez-Diaz case presumably had even more notice than the lawyer in Hinojos Mendoza, because at least in Melendez-Diaz, the statute required these specific certifications and affirmations pursuant to the specific statute. So when council gets that and it looks like it's supposed to under the statute, council knows, hey, they're going to pursue admission of this under the statute. But Melendez-Diaz says, you know, that's not enough that you're given the opportunity for cross-examination. So that's where I think our analysis in Colorado falls down.
Right, but on the, assuming we get to the statute is constitutional,
right.
Just assuming for argument's sake, I guess I heard you to say, you disagree with the part of Hinojosa Mendoza that if the lawyer didn't know, that gets to be a waiver. We, of course, we're bound to follow the Supreme Court.
I understand.
So how do you suggest to get to say no waiver, how do we get around Hinojosa Mendoza?
I think Mojica Sementhal, which is still good law, that this statute can be applied in an unconstitutional manner, and here it was. I don't think also that irrebuttable presumptions are disfavored in the law, and I would think particularly so when they involve constitutional rights. So. And that's what Hinojosa Mendoza and the Coleman case together seem to create this irrebuttable presumption, because at least in the Coleman case, the witness was available, the witness was under the defense subpoena, and still the hearsay report came in. So that's all I have. I would ask you to reverse Mr. Cropper's convictions in this case, and I will get my supplemental brief filed.
Thank you, Ms. Freire. Ms. Pratt?
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803, assistant attorney general appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. Our argument this afternoon is that the defendant validly waived his right to confront the lab experts in this case because his attorney did not follow the notification requirement set out in 16.3309. Therefore, there was no error in this case. The defendant claims, however, that the statute is unconstitutional. So I want to undertake that analysis here. First of all, 16.3309 is constitutional on its face. Mojica Sementhal says that it is, and Hinojosa Mendoza agreed, saying the burden placed on the defendant was minimal in this case. And the United States Supreme Court, its most recent opinion, the Melendez-Diaz, also said in dicta that the notice and demand statutes like Colorado will likely be constitutional, although we'll know for sure next term.
Do you disagree with Ms. Freire's argument that, well, I suppose you do, but tell me why, that Colorado statute does not require notice and therefore it's distinguishable from the statutes that the Supreme Court cited?
I don't agree, and this was raised for the first time today, so I'm not ready with resources, but I can tell you that we have Rule 16 in this state, and under Rule 16, the defense got a copy of the lab reports and knew what was in the lab reports and would presumably know if there was something they wanted to cross-examine. If they knew the law, as they're presumed to know, they would know whether they wanted to examine that person or not.
As a factual matter, Ms. Pratt, was the on a witness list, was the actual lab technician listed as a witness?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. As applied, the first thing our Supreme Court did in Hinojosa Mendoza was it held that the right to confrontation is a right that defense counsel can waive through strategic decisions such as choosing whether or how to undergo cross-examination, and this is the first time that I found out that the defense now agrees with that. But Hinojosa Mendoza specifically deals with the language in Mojica Sementhal that suggested otherwise, that it was not a personal, that it was a personal right, by saying that any reference to personal waiver in Mojica Sementhal was dicta and based on a faulty premise. So I don't agree that Mojica Sementhal is still good law. I think it's been overruled on that point, but it wasn't specifically overruled because it was dicta. So I think the Supreme Court saying it was dicta and based on a faulty premise is enough to say it's in the past. And it wouldn't really be workable to have it any other way. I mean, think of the logistical problems that would occur if the right were personal to the defendant, where there were a number of witnesses in a trial, and where the defendant would have to personally waive his right to confront each and every one of them, perhaps even question by question. So, now, secondly, the defendant claims that 16.3309 is unconstitutional as applied to him because his attorney made a mistake, thinking that the notification provision only applied to a certain class of of cases, certain kind of evidence. However, Hinojos Fundeo stands for the proposition that it doesn't matter what the defendant's attorney thought, because it's presumed that A, Colorado attorneys know the law, and B, that courts can presume that counsel made an affirmative decision not to cross-examine that witness, just as they make the decision how and whether and how much to cross-examine other witnesses in a particular case. Now, the defendant's argument was, in the briefs, was that counsel's mistake was reasonable and therefore excusable, and that isn't something that this court can review. Rather, the decision is whether the decision about whether counsel's actions are reasonable or strategic is something for a post-conviction court to decide. The Hinojos Mendoza opinion very clearly says we're going to presume Sixth Amendment effective assistance of counsel. We're going to presume an affirmative choice by counsel to confront or not confront that witness, and we're going to presume that the attorneys know the law. Any rebutting of that presumption goes on in a collateral case. It would go on in a 35C court where they're best equipped to deal with counsel's testimony and best equipped to take evidence on what the standard of care is within the community. Lastly, even if the defendant's right to confrontation had been violated under this statute, any error would necessarily be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The correct standard for assessing constitutional error looks at the cumulative, corroborative, contradictory nature of the lab reports within the context of the evidence that's in the case. And here we had a strong case against the defendant. The defendant was essentially caught in the act of robbing the townhome. The police were called while the burglary was in progress. He was caught right outside the SUV where the stolen goods were later found, giving rise to a very strong inference that that's why he was there. He was there putting the stuff into the car.
I'm sorry to interrupt, counsel. My memory is I thought that the one officer that first arrived in the scene could not identify this defendant.
Oh, no, he could. He identified him when they stopped him about 10 blocks away on Colorado Boulevard.
Right, but at the scene at the Explorer, the car that was parked there, there were two individuals when the police officer drove up. And my memory, I thought, was that he could not identify this defendant.
Oh, he could. He couldn't remember what shirt he was wearing, but he could remember the defendant. He identified him when he was apprehended on Colorado Boulevard, and he ID'd him at trial. So, and in the old days, eyewitness identification, before we had DNA, that was the gold standard for proving a case. So we did have an eyewitness identification here. The lab reports, now in that context, the lab reports on hair and fingerprints were exculpatory, so we don't really need to deal with those. The footprint report said only that the defendant's shoe might have made the imprint on the door, and that was entirely cumulative to Officer Swanson's testimony that the defendant was wearing a K-Swiss athletic shoe when he was arrested, and there was a K-Swiss brand of shoe footprint found on the door. So that what was in the report can be inferred from the evidence that Officer Swanson gave. And then the DNA report with the DNA on the bottle that was thrown away, that was cumulative to the officer's identification testimony because it puts the defendant at the time and place that the robbery occurred outside the Explorer. So for these reasons, any error would necessarily be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. If there are no further questions, the people respectfully request that the defendant's convictions and sentence be affirmed.
I did have a question, Ms. Pratt. I take away your big finish.
It's fine. It's why I'm here.
I understand where you're pointing us to in Hinojos Mendoza that talks about, you know, the ineffective assistance claim and properly being raised in the 35C. I guess I'm not sure I read it to say that's the only way you can raise it. And so I guess I'm asking you to address, why couldn't we address the issue on direct appeal if the facts appear of record? I mean, it seems to be undisputed that this lawyer just misinterpreted the statute. And so why, I mean, it seems to be inefficient for us to kind of have to wait for a 35C if the facts are of record and could be decided today. So would you address that?
Well, I'm not sure that this attorney, if this court is going to find the attorney ineffective, I'm not sure that this attorney has had an opportunity to fully defend herself.
And that may be where we're disagreeing, and excuse me for interrupting, but I'm not sure, couldn't we say, there are two separate issues. One, we can look at it as an ineffective assistance claim. The other, we could look at it as an issue of whether this presumption listed in or mentioned in Hinojosa-Mendoza has been rebutted or not. If we focus it as a rebuttable presumption issue, it seems like that could be the kind of thing we could take up on direct appeal versus in the context of ineffective assistance. I could be wrong, and I'm willing to be corrected.
The way I read Hinojosa-Mendoza is that Justice Rice says, we leave the issue of whether or not this mistake is ineffective assistance to another day. But the issue about whether or not the presumption that's rebuttable is whether or not counsel was effective. I mean, it's a Sixth Amendment claim, like confrontation, but it's a right to effective assistance of counsel, and that's why you take it into a collateral proceeding.
All right, so your read of the presumption is basically a restatement of the first prong of Strickland.
Correct.
Okay, I understand.
That's exactly, and that's why it's collateral.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Ms. Frederick, thank you again for your argument. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. We look forward to receiving your supplemental briefs, and the case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. So we're now